Your financial choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I am a CPA, CFP professional, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com. And you can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org or on the WDIY app, as well as many streaming services. Today is February 19th, 2025. The markets were up today with the Dow closing at 44,627, the NASDAQ at 20,056, and the S&P at 6,144. Tonight we are taking listeners' tax questions. We are live tonight. We'll take your questions. Bob and Cindy are in the studio with us this evening. We'll answer your calls, take your information, and we ask you to mute your radio so you can hear me without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic and I will do my best to answer them. The number is 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with us, or if you're not comfortable talking live, you can give your question to Cindy, and she'll write it down, and they'll bring it into the studio. You can also submit questions through yourfinancialchoices.com. So again, listeners' tax questions. So I could just sit here in silence waiting for the phones to ring. But I would love if we had some brave callers who called in and asked some questions. We do have general questions that we get, you know, quite frequently, and I asked a few of my colleagues at the office what kinds of questions are they getting, and there seems to be sometimes a consistency of questions that people ask, so I will go over some of those as well. Again, so the phone number is 610-758-8810. One thing I want to kind of maybe start with might be itemizing, because it does still seem to be a confusing question for some people. They'll say, you know, should I give you my medical expenses and should I give you my charitable giving and how much can I take for charitable giving and what's the deduction I'm allowed for charitable giving? So let me just kind of explain that and give a tiny bit of background on that. Many years ago, when we had the tax legislation prior to the 2016 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, or the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, I should say, more people itemized their deductions. That means the IRS gives us two ways to get kind of some tax benefits for, you know, expenses that we have in general, homeowners, people who work, people who are charitable. There was some kind of remedy to give us some benefit, tax benefit, two ways. One was called the standard deduction, and the other one is to itemize deductions. And one would itemize deductions if it was going to be more than your standard deduction. And the standard deduction was just kind of a flat number. Let's give that to everybody. But then there would be people who were in home ownership, who had mortgage interest, people who worked, who had high state income tax or real estate taxes, or people who were charitably inclined and had charitable giving. Some people had high medical expenses. And then there were people who had what we call miscellaneous itemized deductions, things like safe deposit boxes, investment subscriptions, legal fees, perhaps, gambling losses. So there were certain investment fee deductions. So there were certain kinds of deductions that were called miscellaneous itemized deductions. So if we added those all up, subject to certain limitations on those deductions, that would be where we would itemize on Schedule A. And then you'd say, okay, if my itemized deductions on Schedule A are higher than the standard deduction, that's what you would do. the people who, and either way, we also had something called exemption. So there was an additional deduction for how many people were on the tax return. If it was just you, if it was you and a spouse and some kids, there was something else called exemptions. Well, with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, they removed the exemptions. No more exemptions. They raised the standard deduction, and they reduced the amount of deductions one could take if they thought they could itemize. So they raised the standard deduction, which already made that maybe better than, you know, itemizing for some people. And then in itemizing, they took away the miscellaneous itemized deductions, and they put a cap on the tax deduction for state or local taxes paid from work and real estate taxes. So they lowered that. They also put some caps on, you know, some mortgage interest deductions. All right. So, and then removed, as I said, the miscellaneous itemized deductions. So we saw many more people not itemizing. And so when you say, should I give you my medical expenses? Well, if you don't itemize, then there's no point to give us the medical expenses. And for example, the medical expenses are also limited. You can't deduct, it's limited to 7.5% of your adjusted gross income, basically. So if your adjusted gross income is $100,000 times 7.5%, that's $7,500. If your medical expenses exceed $7,500, that would be the amount you could deduct. So in my story, let's pretend that's $10,000 less $7,500. So now we have $2,500 of medical. Well, $2,500 of medical, that still doesn't get us anywhere near the standard deduction. Standard deduction for married filing joint, not factoring in any age adjustments, is almost $30,000. So let's just use that because it's easier to talk those numbers. In my story, I said $2,500 of medical, the standard deduction's $30. Well, you're not there then. Well, then you say, well, yeah, but I paid real estate taxes and I live in New Jersey. My real estate taxes are really high. It's $12,000. Well, that's capped at $10,000. So I worked, Lori, I worked. I paid state taxes. That was $20,000. Well, nope, sorry, capped at $10,000. So now I have $2,500 of medical, and I have $10,000 of taxes as a deduction. So that's $12,000 in my, or $12,500 in my little story here. And now you say, oh, but I was charitable. I was charitable. I gave away $2,000. So now we're at $14,500, still well below the standard deduction. You might get there faster if you're single, because the single standard deduction is $14,600. So where I would see probably more people itemizing might be a single person who's also a homeowner, who has, you know, taxes, even though they're capped at $10,000. They might have mortgage interest. Mortgage interest could be a very big deduction. But the medical quite often doesn't really move the needle. Where I see medical expenses really making a difference, and this is where you really have to pay attention, knock, knock, let's really pay attention here, where I really see this make a difference is when we have elderly parents or elderly relatives who may be in nursing care facilities or assisted living that have, you know, medical expenses related to their stay there, where their other income may be lower. They might have just Social Security or maybe a little pension, maybe a little IRA distribution, and their medical expenses are quite high. So then if we take that 7.5% of some low amount of income, the medical expense could be a fairly big deduction. And this is where some tax planning might come into play. If Grandma or Aunt Betty still has high medical expenses and perhaps has an IRA, you may actually want to put more income on the tax return despite the limitation, the medical limitation. If the medical expenses are so high that there's no income taxable. So I have seen where we have medical expenses of $100,000 and no taxable income. So in that story, we're wasting tax brackets. If there's an opportunity to put more income on a tax return in that story, despite the little bit of the haircut on that limitation, it may make sense to do an IRA conversion to a Roth. So, or take an opportunity to take some money out, especially if Aunt Betty's going to be on the mend and not have such medical expenses in the future. All right? So that's just one example. We'll talk more about Schedule A and itemizing when we come back from the break. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Thank you to all of WDIY's generous sustaining members. Setting up an automatic monthly gift on your credit card is the easiest way to support your listening and ensure WDIY remains a strong and thriving public resource. Become a sustaining member of WDIY today. Call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or visit WDIY.org. Thank you for your support.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY. Tonight's topic, listeners' tax questions. So if you have questions, if something's holding you up from getting your return finished, let's see if we can help. The phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with me, or if you're not comfortable talking live, just give your question to Cindy. I'm explaining some of the common questions we get regarding, you know, in this case, deductions. So I think I've covered that as far as medical goes. And let's talk about charitable giving quickly. Charitable giving, there's a number of ways for people to do charitable giving. I've done shows, you know, solely on this topic. So you can scroll through our list of podcasts on WDIY.org. It's under Public Affairs or on Your Financial Choices. But a number of ways of giving. Number one, if you give cash and you come in and you say to me, well, Lori, I am going to itemize. I have a lot of mortgage interest and I have some taxes. My charitable giving was, let me see, maybe $5,000. I have to ask, do you have receipts? You have to have a receipt for gifts of, you know, donations to 501c3s of $250 or more, and or, you know, credit card receipts, check, canceled checks. But typically the charity is required to give you, you know, documentary evidence of your donation. So you want to make sure you have that in your records in case you're ever audited. And that would be like cash, credit cards, checks. Then you could also gift appreciated securities. Appreciated securities, you gift them and get a deduction of fair market value. You don't have to sell the securities. That's a triple benefit here because you don't have income tax on the sale of the assets for federal or for state. Plus, in this story, this person's getting a deduction, so they still could benefit from a tax deduction on that donation. Typically, you can bunch those deductions into 1 year by giving a lump sum, bunch them, do a multiple number of securities for to a donor-advised fund. So that is something to do, and I'll talk more about those in a minute. But we have a caller on the air. We have Gail from Phillipsburg. Gail, can you hear me? Hi, Gail. Gail?
Did you hear me?
Oh, sorry, it's Carl. I apologize. I read it wrong. It's Carl. Hi, Carl. How can I help you?
Hi, Helen.
Good.
Yes, the reason I was calling is I was wondering about investing and you incur certain costs when you invest.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered about the deductibility of those costs to offset the capital gains and interest.
Yeah, there's a couple costs to investing, Carl. And when you're paying, for example, an asset management fee for those investments, you're hiring a financial advisor. Before the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, that actually could have been a miscellaneous itemized deductions for those assets that were managed that were not retirement accounts. When you have asset management fees from a retirement account, that has no tax impact, no tax cost, and no deduction then. So there was a deduction then, but they eliminated the miscellaneous itemized, and that was subject to a limitation of 2% of your total income. They eliminated that, so we don't get that deduction anymore. There could still be some brokerage fees or trade commissions. We're not seeing those as often. More advisors are on what we call a registered investment advisory platform, where they're taking asset management fees and not so much commissions anymore. The commissions are kind of baked into the sale price, though, of the investment. So if you sold something and there was a commission on that sale, that gets netted out on the sale. So that is a Schedule D transaction, but we're not typically seeing a deduction for asset management fees. Okay, does that help?
It does help.
Okay.
It's a terribly pleasing answer, but it does help.
Okay. Well, if the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act goes away, then miscellaneous itemized deductions might come back as well. But, you know, quite often people may not have fully benefited from that either if their income was so high that it wiped out that it's 2% of the page one income. So that was not ever really a very big deduction for people. Okay. All right. But thank you for calling. Have a good evening.
You too, Lori.
Thank you. Bye. So for the charitable giving, we've talked about cash. We've talked about appreciated securities, which was, you know, a really great way. And you can maximize that deduction when you maybe bunch it all into 1 year and perhaps do it to a donor advised fund. You get that deduction in that 1 year. It, when you're doing appreciated securities, though, it is subject to and long-term holdings over a year, it's subject to a 30% limitation, 30% of your total income, again, adjusted gross income. And then, so if your adjusted gross income is $100,000, 30% of that is $30,000. So if I donate appreciated securities valued at $30,000, I would get that as a deduction on Schedule A, subject to, you know, what other limitations or calculations are there. But I didn't have to pay any tax on the gain on those securities. So that's something to think about. Another way, so that's appreciated securities. It doesn't have to be appreciated securities. It could even be, you know, artwork or other types of items. But it's the fair market value for the most part, unless it's something like you created yourself. So I can't do a painting. I got messed up on this many, many years ago, like two decades ago. A painting that I paint myself, and I'm making this story up, might be, you know, I could sell it maybe for $2,000, but it only cost me $50 of paint to make that painting. If I donate that painting, I don't get to donate it for $2,000 because I didn't realize or pay $2,000 for it. I only paid $50 for it. So in that story, it's my own creation. I only get the deduction for $50. I don't get deduction for the $2,000. Now, if someone bought it for $2,000 and then they donated it, the value to them was $2,000. But, you know, that's because that's what they put out for it. So we have to kind of be sensitive to how we calculate these numbers. Always ask a professional to help you with that. And these kinds of donations are reported on Form 8283, and they flow through to the Schedule A. Now, there are times when, even with all that, we still may not be able to itemize deductions because, again, the standard deduction is so high. So what other ways are there to give that are really quite impactful? And that is something I talk about all the time, which is once you reach either required minimum distribution age, which is 73, moving up to age 75, or even age 70 and a half, the old RMD age. That's the old RMD age, required minimum distribution age, where the IRS says you have to take money out of your retirement accounts. They used to say you had to take it out at 70 and a half. And with that, they also said, or you could take money and give it to charity, a 501c3, out of your IRA, not out of your 401k, but out of your IRA at 70 and a half. So while they raised the age for the required minimum distribution, they did not raise the age for the qualified charitable distribution, the QCD. So you can do charitable giving out of an IRA and not pay any tax on it to a 501c3. It's awesome. Best way of giving. Love it. Love it. Love it. because an IRA distribution comes out at ordinary income tax rates. So if I have a $20,000 RMD and I decide to give $20,000 to my favorite 501c3, I report zero income on the tax return for that. So that doesn't even matter if I itemize. I'm getting a full deduction. Whereas if I did $20,000 out of my bank account, there's a chance I wouldn't get any deduction for it under this newer standard deduction scheme or whatever you call it. Okay? So IRAs are great for giving to nonprofit 501c3s. Folks, it is listeners' tax questions tonight. So if you have questions, you're welcome to give us a call. Phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Tune up your week with a great variety of jazz music on WDIY. Monday through Friday nights from 9 to 11 offers many choices from the world of jazz, featuring traditional to modern styles, plus swing Sunday at 5 p.m. and improvisational jazz on the bridge Sunday nights at 10 p.m. Listen for new releases, interviews with artists, and information on upcoming performances right here on WDIY.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices, and tonight we're talking about listeners' tax questions. You can talk live on air with us, or if you're not comfortable talking live, just give your question to Cindy, and she'll write it down, and they'll bring it in. So listeners' tax questions, 610-758-8810. Charitable giving, we covered that. Really like the IRA. Oh, by the way, you don't have to do the full RMD. You can do a smaller amount than the RMD, or you can do more than the RMD. And they have recently adjusted the amount of the cap of giving to charity from your IRA. It used to be $100,000 cap per person, and I think it's like $108,000, $109,000 now. It moves up with inflation, so I haven't put that to memory yet, but I think when I last looked, it was almost like $108,000. So you can give a lot to charity, but if your RMD is 20, you can give 2, 3, 4, 5, 20, or more, 100, whatever. Okay, just subject to that one cap, but it has to be to a 501c3, and the contribution has to come directly from the IRA. It cannot be put into your bank account and then done. You have to do it right away. Right from the custodian. And we have another caller. We have Dave from Nazareth. Hi, Dave. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Lori.
Great. How can I help you?
Yeah, my question is that I did a direct trustee-to-trustee rollover of my health savings account.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, should I be expecting a 1099 document from the old trustee for that transaction?
I don't think you'll see one, Dave, if it was a trustee-to-trustee transfer. And the reason I'm kind of saying I think is because from time to time, when we see people move retirement accounts to, like, rollover IRAs, quite often I'll say, oh, it was a trustee-to-trustee transfer. We may not see any tax document. And then here we get a tax document that shows that it was a rollover with a code G, which shows trustee-to-trustee transfer, not taxable. So, there are instances where I think sometimes we're not going to see tax documents in a trustee-to-trustee transfer, but then there are times we do see it. But I think you would have already received it. If you were going to get it, I think you already would have gotten it. Now, they do, and I can't recall the form off the top of my head, like 1098Q or something. There's the form to show when someone makes a contribution or a distribution from an HSA, so you may
correct
still get that. But I don't know if it would be like what you mentioned, like a 1099R, because that, it's a different kind of animal here, but.
All right. Good.
Okay.
And I haven't made a distribution or a contribution, so I didn't receive that 1098 form.
Okay.
So yeah, that the issue with the rollover was the only thing holding me up.
Okay.
filing my taxes now. So, okay.
And Dave, one other note. Just remember, now that you've rolled it over to the new trustee, make sure you checked that you've invested it, because sometimes if it comes over, it's going to go into like a cash account. And those HSAs are wonderful because they grow tax-free. So you want to make sure that to the extent you're not, don't think you're going to be using some of it, you could get it invested.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I did, Lori. I did this earlier in 2024, so it took a while for the actual transfer to occur. But once you're correct, it did go directly into a cash account at the new trustee, and then I then moved a larger portion of that into an investment account.
Great,
so.
great. Okay, good job. Thank you for calling. I appreciate the question. Thank you, Dave.
All right,
thank you very much. Bye-bye.
All right, you too.
Bye. And we have Greg from Bethlehem. Hi, Greg. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Great, I can. How can I help you?
Just a real quick question.
Mm-hmm.
I've been retired for the last 5 years, so that means I have no earned income.
Yep.
And yet every year, I don't know why, I look for the local income tax form online,
uh-huh.
fill it out, mark the box that I'm retired,
uh-huh.
hit zero, and sign it. They never send me the form. I'm assuming they don't want to hear from me anymore until I make earned income. Is that a correct assumption and I don't need to file this tax anymore?
Yeah, I would say it's a safe assumption. So especially if you're the one who's kind of initiating the filing of that form, because normally if we check that box retired, I think that kind of alerts the local that then they no longer have to send out the local form. You know, the old paper one, yes, they still send those out. So if they have not sent you one and you're going online and filing it, once you've checked that box retired and they're no longer receiving a W-2 reflecting local wages, because they're coordinating with the state of Pennsylvania. So if the state of Pennsylvania doesn't show any wages for you, they let the local know there's no wages. Or if there were wages, they would let the local know. And then the local is going to be on you for sure saying, hey, where's your tax return? But yeah, in these circumstances, no wages. There's no cross-reporting between Pennsylvania and local. You've marked the box retired. They know not to expect it. Yeah, so give yourself a break. Take extra 5 minutes to do something for yourself other than that. So,
sounds good.
It's a great question, though. I love it because locals are the worst. They're the worst tax.
They always end up being zero in all the years I've lived in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. So, okay, Greg, thank you for the call. Have a good night.
You are.
Folks, if you have questions, phone number is 610-758-8810. I love questions, and let me tell you why I love questions, because we always learn something from our listeners. I'm going to repeat, WDIY has sophisticated listeners. You ask great questions, you're great listeners. I appreciate it, and I appreciate sharing, you know, the questions that you have with our audience, because if you have a question and you were brave enough to call in and ask it, I guarantee you a lot of other people also have those same questions. They're just not as brave to call. So we talked about itemizing. More people do not itemize as much as used to. Another question we get often is political contributions. Can I deduct political contributions? And most of us should know this by now, that no, political contributions are not tax deductible. Sometimes people will ask about gifting. How much can I gift? And the default in everyone's head, it's so interesting to me how this becomes ingrained, and I don't know where it comes from, but people will say, oh, I can gift $10,000, right? And that comes from, for many, many, many years, the gift exemption was $10,000. And what are you talking about, gift exemption? What that means is I can give $10,000 in the old days to anybody I wanted, and I didn't have to report it to anybody. I could give $10,000 to anyone, didn't have to report it, they didn't have to report it. But that was changed some years ago, and they started putting an inflation rider on that, and now the gift amount is $19,000 in 2025. $19,000 I can give to anyone, and I don't have to report it, and the person who's receiving it doesn't have to report it. What am I talking about? Like, I don't have to report it. When would I have to report it? What does it mean? Is it income tax? No, it's gift tax. And when does a gift tax apply? A gift tax applies only when we give away more money than our lifetime exemption determined by the IRS. And the lifetime exemption is like almost $14 million, people. So even if I gave you $1 million, I might have to file a gift tax return, but I don't have to pay any gift tax. Gift tax doesn't kick in until we give away more than that. So there's only a few people probably in the country that have to file a gift tax return where they actually pay gift tax. Most of us don't have to pay gift tax, and most of us really aren't even gifting that much. I quite often see people gifting the annual amount, and I can talk more about that when we come back from this break. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. We'll be back in just a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Welcome back. If you have questions, phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. You can talk live on air with me, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, just give your question to Cindy. And the topic tonight, listeners' tax questions, and it can be off topic as well, but that's, you know, kind of our topic this evening for people who are new. We do tend to have topics. And podcasts of prior shows are also available on many streaming services, and as well WDIY.org and the WDIY app and yourfinancialchoices.com. So when I talked about the gift, the annual exclusion, pretty easy. Where I see that the most is, you know, parents who are of comfortable wealth, they may give their kids, you know, cash gifts at Christmas, adult children. I see grandparents quite often gifting to either their children or their grandchildren. And in the for the grandchildren, when they're gifting for the grandchildren, we have to be kind of careful even how we gift to our to grandchildren, because there are, you know, if our grandchild is a minor, then they cannot take like custody of that asset. So I have seen where the grandparent will open up an account for the grandchild, and they will be the custodian of that account with the grandchild as the beneficiary of it. We call it an UTMA account, a Uniform Transfer to Minors Act account. And it's the minor's social security number, so that income gets reported in the minor's social security number. It gets reported on their tax return if it's of such an amount that requires a tax return. It may or may not. And if then the custodian passes away and that's minor, there would be a new custodian appointed. If the child, the minor, reaches age of majority, the custodian steps aside. The child now takes full responsibility for the account and gets switched into their name alone, and everything kind of stays the same. When that child is below a certain age, they may be subject to something called the kiddie tax. So depending on how much money the child makes in that investment account and how much the parents make, the child may be, income may be subject somewhat to the parents' tax rates, meaning some of the income would get taxed at the child's rate and some may be, have some exposure to the parents. It all depends. I'm not going to even go in to try to explain that tonight, but it could add a little bit level of complication to it when there may be other alternatives. And let me talk to you about some of the other alternatives. If you're a grandparent and you're thinking about gifting to, grandchildren, you could gift, as we just mentioned, custodial account, which is held as an account. You could gift to an education account called a Section 529 account. 529 stands for the Internal Revenue Code section that governs education accounts. So it could go into a 529 account. Certain states offer either tax credits or tax deductions for contributions to 529 accounts. And Pennsylvania has some of the best rules on that, meaning I could make a contribution to your kid, listener, and as long as I had your kid's name and social security number and I had income, I could take a deduction. And it doesn't matter where the 529 plan is. It could be anywhere in the country, and I get a deduction for that. It's to encourage education. So we could get a deduction to the extent we have income. and subject to those annual exemptions. So $19,000. I could put $19,000 into my child's 529 account and get a deduction on my Pennsylvania return. And other states have other similar types of credits. Not all states do, but some states do. For example, New York requires that it be a New York plan. Indiana has to be an Indiana plan. Ohio, I think Ohio may have to be an Ohio plan as well, or there's a different deduction for Ohio. Some of those states allow, and Virginia, I think, is the Virginia plan. But Pennsylvania could be, a Virginia plan, and I could still contribute to it. So that is 529 funding for education. It grows income tax-free. The income over those years is not reported. So you can kind of see there's a lot of benefits to having it in the 529 versus a custodial account. And as long as it's used for qualified education expenses, there's no tax on those earnings over those years. So a lot of different advantages, and there's lots of nuances to that. So at another time, I'll do a show probably just on education funding. The another option could be to, if your grandchildren are working, that they're at such an age where they have employment income, they may be responsible. Parents might say, hey, Bobby, you need to get a job and pay for your own kind of extracurricular activities. We're not going to pay for you to buy Legos or games or something, video games. And so the child works and they're really responsible. You like them. And it's okay if they have a little bit of fun because they're such hard workers and they do well in school, but they have used up kind of their money for, their other expenses. So they made $7,000 at their part-time job. As a grandparent, in lieu of, if the 529 doesn't seem to be an option, you could always gift to the child the amount of money to put into a Roth IRA. A Roth IRA is a retirement account whereby invested, it grows income tax-free as well. Income tax-free forever if it's in a qualified distribution, meaning the longer of 5 years or age 59 and a half, it would be tax-free. And you might say, well, Lori, this kid's only, 17 and they may need that money at some point. Well, they can always take out the original contributions. And it doesn't matter if, you put it in or they put it in. They can take out the original contributions without any tax consequence because a Roth IRA does not get a tax deduction up front. And it can grow income tax-free. So another great way to help your grandchildren save, to pass on, wealth and concepts of investing and, getting them engaged and learning what the meaning of saving is. I always say that when people start to see the fruits of their effort, it's empowering and it can, create this snowball effect of, being responsible and taking care of your financial situation, whether it's reducing debt or increasing your saving and being smart about your investing too. So that is gifting. We were talking about gifting, so various ways to gift. One other item about gifting. So we talked about those annual exemptions. You may say, gosh, my daughter's been in a really hard time. She's had a lot of medical problems. And boy, I'd really like to help her out as much as I can, but I'm limited to this annual gift and I don't want to file a gift tax return. Well, if your daughter is also having a lot of medical expenses, if you make payments directly to medical providers, that does not count as a gift. So if a child, a grandchild, niece, nephew, someone is having high medical costs outside of their insurance, maybe the prescriptions are really high, and you pay for it directly, that does not count as a gift. Also, if you pay tuition directly, it does not count as a gift. It does not count as a gift. And in addition, I forgot, with the 529, one of the qualified distributions is elementary school or secondary school tuition up to $10,000. So if your grandchildren are in private school and you're paying, $6,000 of tuition, that could be a distribution from the 529 account. And maybe you've already kept out the 529 and you want to save that for college. Well, you could make the check directly to the elementary school for $6,000, and that doesn't count as a gift because it's tuition. All right? So I hope that helps with the gifting and taking care of gift tax types of things. Tax estimates is another question that seems to come up. We have clients who ask. I had one of my colleagues said that she got a question. I got a raise, and now I'm afraid I'm going to owe a lot of money because I'm in a higher tax bracket. You know, what do I do about that? And then there was a further question related to that about how the tax brackets work. So as far as paying taxes, someone might wonder, how do we pay taxes? It is a pay-as-you-go system, and the way we can pay as we go, typically when we're working, we have wages and our employer withholds our federal tax, our state tax, our local tax, our Social Security tax, our Medicare tax. They withhold and take care of that for us. It doesn't mean they actually know how much we owe. I'm always, always surprised when people say, but my employer already withheld the tax. I don't understand why I owe. They withheld it already, and they don't realize because the employer doesn't know what other income you have. They might not know that you're married and your spouse makes $1 million. They might not know that your spouse doesn't work and makes zero, so they withhold too much. The employer isn't expected to know your tax situation. All they know is how much you make and what you completed on your W-4 form. The W-4 is what you fill out when you are employed for the first time, and you tell them what your filing status is. Are you single? Are you married? Are you married? Filing separate. And now there's more boxes on the W-4. You can check a box that says, oh, I'm married, but my spouse works too. Imagine, you know, when I was young, there were so many spouses, women in particular, who weren't working, and you'd have one earner in the home and the other would be stay at home, typically the mom. And so the withholdings might have always seemed to work out. Well, then we, you know, society evolved and now more women are working and now we have two wage earners in the home and now the taxes get all messed up because they're only looking at maybe one earner's wages and said, oh, they're married filing joint. They have a $30,000 standard deduction. And then they look at the wife's W-2 and say, oh, she's working and she makes this money. Oh, and she's married and she has a $30,000 standard deduction. No, that's not how it works, because when you're married, two spouses, you would have one standard deduction for married filing joint. And I, you know, I used husband, wife, but it could be husband, husband, wife, wife. So whatever it might be, married filing joint, you want to fill out the W-4 to say that there are two earners, if that is the case, and that could kind of equalize it a little bit. It still may not completely withhold the proper amount, particularly if you have other income on your tax return. So if you have, you know, pensions or you have interest and dividends or big capital gains, then the withholding on your wages may not cover the taxes on your investment income. And there are no withholdings typically on investment income. So you may have to either adjust your withholdings, which you can do also on the W-4. You can fill out a new W-4 and say withhold extra taxes. Or you could do quarterly estimated tax payments. And each quarter, it's actually not quite quarters. It's April 15th, June 15th, September 15th, and January 15th of the next year for the prior year, because they give you a little wiggle room to kind of make up in that last quarter. Then you could do quarterly estimated payments. Quite often I might see this on the state level when someone stops working, so they don't have as much like in wages for federal, but maybe at the state level they still have investment income with no withholdings and not as big of deductions or exemptions sometimes. And so you may be doing state estimates without doing federal estimates. But you can pay your taxes through either withholding or through quarterlies. I'll also add, if you're someone who has IRAs, you have required minimum distributions, you may want to think about doing those at the end of the year or consider them at the end of the year if you don't need the money throughout the year, because you could actually calculate your withholding in December and withhold it all from your IRA or part of it from your IRA because the IRS deems withholdings to be made evenly throughout the year. So even though you didn't do quarterlies, it's deemed to have been made evenly throughout the year. So I quite often will do that and wait on the required minimum distributions until, you know, October, November, December, so I have a better idea of what the income is for the taxpayer, and I adjust the withholdings. I either increase them or decrease them, and that way it looks like, you know, they've paid evenly throughout the year. Folks, we're at the last break. If you have questions, phone number is 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices right here on WDIY. If you have questions, phone number is 610-758-8810. We still have time. You could also submit questions through yourfinancialchoices.com, and I'll reply to those directly. Yourfinancialchoices.com. After the show, I won't be able to see them during the show. One other part of that other question we had was something about the tax rate. So this person was like, oh my gosh, I'm making more money. I'm now in a higher tax bracket. So let me just explain that really quickly. We have, for example, a married filing joint. And if we have someone who's married filing joint and their taxable income is about $201,000, the taxes, that means they would just be in the 24% tax bracket. So someone might think, oh, I'm in the 24% tax bracket, but it's only the next incremental dollar. So just be aware that it doesn't mean you're paying 24% on all of your income. It's only on that tier of income. We have basically zero for the amount that's either the standard deduction or the Schedule A amount. We have 10% for married filing joint up to $23,000, and then from 23 to 94 something, it's like 12%, and then 94 to 201 is like 22%, and then 201 to 383, and I'm talking hundred thousands, it's 24%, and then it goes on 32, 35, 37. And for single people, up to after the deductions, then it's up to 11,600 is at 10%, 11,6 to 47 is 12%, 47 to 100 is 22%. So there's tiers. So just because you're in a 22% tax bracket doesn't mean you're paying 22% flat tax. It's only for that incremental dollar within that tier. So be aware of that. And let me add to that, that if you have qualified dividends or long-term capital gains, those qualify for a lower tax rate as well. If you're in a 12% tax bracket or lower, the capital gains or qualified dividends, long-term capital gains or qualified dividends are taxed at zero. So I could have someone who might have, you know, $94,000 of taxable income on their tax return. They're in a 12% tax bracket. They could have $94,000 of qualified dividends or long-term capital gains and pay zero tax. Qualified dividends from investments in equities. Qualified dividends from long-term capital gains on your investments in equities, or it could be, you know, other types of capital assets. Zero when you're in the 12% tax bracket. And let's pretend you might have some wages and some qualified dividends. So to the extent you're still in the 12% bracket, your wages might be taxed at ordinary rates, but the capital gains and the qualified dividends would still be taxed at zero. All right? So we wonder why the stock market hit record highs again today. People who have the money who are invested in the market, there are other tax advantages to them as well on their investments that are like an individual or joint accounts. We call that non-qualified money. It doesn't matter kind of the tax status of your investments within an IRA. When the money comes out of the IRA, it's taxed at ordinary rates. I'd just like to, you know, add that as a little extra mention. Sometimes people will think if they have equities in their IRA that they're going to have special tax benefits. They don't. When it comes out of the IRA, it's all income taxable at ordinary income. So that's why I really like to see qualified dividends and equities, you know, that tax-favored treatment on the non-retirement accounts if we're going to put money somewhere. Another big question, energy credits. People talk about energy credits. Lori, I got a new door. Lori, I got new windows. Lori, we got a new heater. Do I get a tax credit? And we're starting to hear about that again because they did change the rules on the energy tax credits. They had capped it out like a lifetime cap many years ago. So when they first had some of these energy credits, everyone was, you know, replacing windows, doors, insulation, heaters, all of that. And then, you know, it got really quiet for a long time. Nobody was doing it anymore because it seemed like everyone had done these improvements and it was a lifetime cap, so we never heard about it again. Well, that lifetime cap, I think, was removed in 2002. And going forward, people can take energy credits again, and I don't believe it has a lifetime cap anymore. But you have to understand what the energy credit is. Don't get all excited about it. It may not be as big or as great as one might think. When you hear, oh, it's 30% of the cost. Well, 30% of the cost sounds like a great credit, but it's capped. So there are caps. And the caps, you have to like lift up the hood. There's a cap for under the hood. There's a cap for the front seat. And there's a cap for the back seat. So the you have to understand what it is you're getting and where you're having these improvements done. So the energy credits are, let me see, I took some notes because it frankly is a bit complicated. And I had a gracious client who asked me a question about it, and I sent her some information, and I said, I don't think it's going to apply here. And then she read what I sent her, and she said, yeah, but isn't that what this is saying? And then I had to dig a little bit deeper, and sure enough, we did uncover a little bit of a broader definition than I had originally thought. So if it's hard for me as a CPA to figure out this stuff, you can imagine how it is for individuals. I printed off a fact sheet from the IRS on the energy credits, and I kid you not, it's 17 pages, 17 pages. So, and it's just about the updates to the frequently asked questions about, let me tell you, energy efficient home improvement credit and the residential clean energy property credit. So different, two different kinds of credits, energy efficient home improvement and the residential clean energy property credit. I wish they would just call it one thing. It would make it easier for us to understand. But these two different credits, they apply differently and they cover different things. So the energy efficient home improvement credit is around, let me see, it is around qualified energy efficiency improvements, which are building envelope components, which include exterior doors, exterior windows and skylights, insulation materials or systems, and air sealing materials or systems. It's up to 30% of the cost, but subject to certain caps. So the caps, there was an annual credit of generally up to $1,200 per credit or per taxpayer. It used to be like $500. So now it's since January 1 of 2023, the amount of the credits equal to 30% of the sum of the amounts paid by the taxpayer during the year, taxable year, for qualified energy improvements installed during the taxable year, residential energy property expenditures, and home energy audits. So the first one, the building envelope, think about doors, windows, insulation materials, envelope of the house. That's principal residence only, principal residence only. Then another part of this credit is called residential energy property expenditures, which is central air conditioners, natural gas, propane, water heaters, boilers, oil furnaces, things like that. That is for a principal residence or a second home, also subject to a cap per item, $600 cap per item. So remember, I said earlier, a $1,200 cap total, but then the exterior doors, 30% of the cost, up to $250 per door. Exterior windows and skylights, 30% of the cost, up to $600. So you hear how that $1,200 cap isn't really $1,200. It depends on how much you do. And let me tell you, the windows are going to be more than $600. So 30% of the cost, but the credit is up to $600. All right. That's principal residence. The central air, natural gas, all of that, principal residence or second home, subject to a cap of $600. And property not subject to the 600 cap are electric or natural gas heat pump water heaters, electric or natural gas heat pumps, biomass stoves or boilers, all kinds of stuff like that. And that, I believe, has a max credit. It's not subject to the 600, but it would be subject to the $1,200 credit, all right? And then the third kind of energy efficient home improvement is a home energy audit. And that also only applies to your principal residence. So you really have to dig in on all of these and make sure it qualifies. Don't make an assumption. And if you ask your accountant to figure out and you're paying per the accountant's time, I'm telling you, it's going to be a nightmare for the accountant. And then it will be a nightmare for you when you get your invoice. If your accountant's trying to figure out what you bought and you didn't give them receipts and you gave them some general terms. So you really have to kind of know what you got. Is there a limit on the total amount of the credit that a taxpayer can claim? I mentioned $1,200, but there is another exception, and that is the residential energy property expenditure for qualified energy property that's capped at $600, except for heat pump water heaters and heat pumps. There's another credit, which is limited to $2,000 for each taxpayer for any taxable year for electric or natural gas heat pump water heaters, electric or natural gas heat pumps. Basically, go to EnergyStar.gov, EnergyStar.gov, and see if you can, you know, put in the information as it might apply to you. Is it a principal residence? Is it a second home? Is it going to qualify? And the person that you could be contracting for these services may or may not know. You want to make sure they know. Back in the day, everyone was giving manufacturer certification, so we really didn't have to think too hard about it. We would just tell our clients, get the manufacturer certification, and that would tell us that that applied, that they met all the energy efficiency standards. And it was fairly easy to kind of enter it then, but I'm not seeing people get those manufacturer certifications anymore. But there are websites that you can go on and sometimes enter the model and make of whatever it is you bought, that split system, that heater, whatever it might be, and then we can find out if you're eligible for those credits. And those are tax credits. Those aren't tax deductions. That is a dollar-for-dollar tax credit. So we really love tax credits because that lowers your income tax. Now, tonight, speaking of tax credits, and I was talking about education earlier, I didn't mention about the education credits that are out there. Also, huge, huge tax credits on education. If you have a student who's in, you know, 4 years of education and you're within the income limits, and you've paid some monies out of pocket, not using, you can't double dip for education expenses, meaning taking it all out of 529 and qualify for education credit. You kind of can coordinate them, though. And I like doing that with clients where you get an education credit, tax credit, which can be up to $2,500 if you have $4,000 of out of pocket for tuition. That's for the American Opportunity Tax Credit. And someone pursuing a four-year degree typically, and you can't take it more than 4 years. But there is also an education credit called the Lifetime Learning Credit, which is up to 20% of $10,000 of tuition. So that's a really nice credit as well, particularly for people who, again, qualify within the income limits, who are pursuing, you know, advanced degrees or beyond the 4 years of education. You can still qualify for a lifetime learning credit. So don't forget about those. folks, we are at the end of the show. I want to thank our listeners for calling in tonight. That was really great. I appreciate it. And I want to thank Bob and Cindy for being here, and Bridger, of course. I do want to mention next week, I'm going to welcome Caitlin Mack, President and COO of LINC. LINC stands for Lehigh Valley Interregional Networking and Connecting Consortium. It's a nonprofit organization that focuses on supporting diverse talent, employers, and communities through learning, inclusion, networking, and connecting. So I'll be happy to welcome her to find out how they're helping people who are new to our area kind of navigate the Lehigh Valley and make it their home and keep them here longer and taking advantage of networking in our community. So we'll have Caitlin Mack next week. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices and have a great week.